genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on live every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ, AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and our theme today is potpourri. All three of my guests have interesting subjects, no two of which are related to one another. My first guest is a venture capitalist, management consultant, and a teacher at Babson College. We're going to discuss the sudden sharp rise in oil prices and the relationship to world events. My second guest will give us recommendations that could literally save our lives during an earthquake. There was a magnitude 6.9 earthquake in Japan, followed by a tsunami, which is headed towards the western coast of the United States right now. Taking simple precautions before an earthquake strikes may mean the difference between surviving or becoming a statistic. My third guest defined musical style during the British invasion in the 1960s. He pioneered a sound that set Herman's Hermits apart from other British rock bands. That style has an enduring legacy even today. And if you want to join in the conversation, remember you can always call us at 639-0008. Peter Cohan is president of Peter S. Cohan & Associates, a management consulting firm. He helps companies in technology-intensive industries to identify, evaluate, and profit from new business opportunities created by changing technology. Peter is a frequent speaker, an author, and a TV commentator on high-end technology. Prior to starting his firm, Peter worked as an internal consultant in the banking and insurance industries. He received his MBA from the Wharton School. He did graduate work in computer science at MIT. And he earned a B.S. in electrical engineering from Swarthmore College. Welcome to the show, Peter. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Well, good to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being my guest today. Let's dive into it, because oil prices are on everybody's mind. Here in California, we're particularly affected by rising gasoline prices, which we'll come to in just a minute. But I noticed before I left to come to the studio today that oil prices are down in today's trading. But that follows several days of rising prices. The unrest in Egypt, the unrest in Liberia, Libya, has really been blamed for the rising prices. However, you believe that's not the whole story. So explain your position, will you please?
Sure. Basically, the price of oil is set by two separate groups of participants in the market. One of them is what you'd expect, namely, say, oil refineries that buy a barrel of oil and then convert it into gasoline, or an airplane, you know, airline that uses it to, you know, fuel airplanes, something like that. There's a lot of people out there who need oil to actually run their operations.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's another group of participants that are Wall Street traders. And what you'd like to see is a situation where the Wall Street traders are sort of on the fringe of the use of trading oil. But what you've really got is that 81%, that's right, 81% of all the trading on the oil markets is done by these Wall Street firms, and the only 19% is done by firms like the refineries or the airlines. So what that means for the price of oil is that these traders can borrow a lot of money, and they use these borrowed money to basically put down very little of their own capital and a lot of the borrowed money to bet on rising prices in a very short period of time, based on the fear that's out there in the headlines. To put this in perspective, if this was solely, if the market was solely controlled by people who actually use oil, there would have been no change in the price of oil at all. And the reason for that is that the amount of oil that the U.S. imports from Libya represents 0.5% of our total oil imports.
Yes.
And not only that, but yes, there was a temporary disruption in the supply, but Saudi Arabia stepped in and is filling that hole created by the stop in the Libyan oil. So, in the meantime, the demand for oil has not increased appreciably during that time. So, basically, if it was just based on supply and demand for oil, the price would not have gone up at all. It's these speculators that are responsible.
All right. So Peter Cohan is our guest. He says that 81% of oil trading is done by Wall Street speculators and that the oil prices would have remained constant had not been for these speculators. Now, Peter, I just want to come back to what you said about Libya represents only 0.5% of all U.S. oil imports. That is true. However, they're a big trading partner with Italy, who used to be their former colonial master. And it does represent a much larger percentage of European oil prices, particularly those Italian imports of oil as well. What contagion is there in the United States if European oil prices rise because of what's going on in Libya?
Well, there is, the contagion is all completely reflected in the prices now. But what's also happening, I think you mentioned this at the top of the show, that oil prices are down. The reason the oil prices are down is because of what happened in Japan. Japan is the third largest economy in the world. It used to be the second up until last year when China overtook it. It's still a huge economy, and the earthquake has led to a decline in the amount of petroleum that it's consuming. They use 4 million barrels of oil a day, and they will not be importing as much as they were for quite some time until they can get back to what had been normal before this earthquake. So that sudden drop in demand more than offsets the loss of supply from Libya. It's not clear exactly how much less Japan is going to be importing, but it seems to me that supply and demand balance just changed because of that earthquake.
All right. We're talking to Peter Cohan, everybody, and we're talking about the rising price of oil, or at least the fluctuating price of oil. Peter, I want to come back to Japan and drill down on that just a little bit more, no pun intended, when we're talking about oil. And you say that Japan is the number three oil consumer in the world. That's true, behind the United States and China, that they use 4 million barrels of oil per day. I did not know that. However, the fact that they've just had the tsunami may or may not have a negative effect on their consumption of oil. It may actually have an increase in the amount of oil. The reason that I'm saying that, or I'm actually asking a question, is a lot of Japan's energy is generated from nuclear power plants. Because of the earthquake and because of the tsunami, those nuclear power plants have gone offline, which means the other power plants, which are generated by fossil fuels, are going to have to pick up the load there. So is it directly evident that 4 million barrels per day is going to go down, or do you think, in fact, it could go up because of their need to produce electricity?
Well, you raise an interesting point and also an area of ignorance on my part. For instance, I don't know, how much of the gasoline that's used or the oil that's used in China is in Japan is going into power plants or would go into power plants. How much would go into people driving their cars, which I suppose there'll be large parts of the country where people won't be driving their cars. The bottom line is I don't know.
Okay.
But based on the reaction to the market, today, in terms of, I don't know if what happens right at this moment, but last time I checked, the price had dropped a few dollars. I think that investors may be concluding that demand is going to be down. But the other thing is that these are all fairly, although obviously incredibly painful, eventually I think Japan will kind of get back to its normal consumption level of oil. So, this is all sort of temporary. Plus, I think before Japan gets back to its normal consumption, I think that things in Libya are going to resolve themselves one way or the other. And unfortunately, it looks like things in Libya are resolving themselves in the form of Muammar Gaddafi reestablishing control of the country. But I'm sure that once he has, he'll probably start pumping out the oil again so he can refill his coffers.
Yeah, without a doubt. We're talking to Peter Cohan, everybody, author of the book Capital Rising and also CEO of Peter S. Cohan and Associates. We're talking about the rising price of oil. Peter, I want to come back to your main thesis, which is that speculators make up 81% of the oil trading that's done every single day here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, first of all, how do speculators profit and how do they make their money speculating in oil? And then secondly, why is this a bad thing?
Well, the answer to the first question is that the speculator can borrow money and buy what's called a futures contract, which is basically gives them the option of purchasing selling oil at a certain price at a certain time in the future. They don't take delivery of the oil. They don't actually use the commodity itself. But what they do is they trade on very short-term fluctuations in the market and use borrowed money to do it, which means that they can make very large profits if their bets are correct. The reason why, I mean, there is some value to having speculators in the market, but what happened was in 1991, there was a change in the regulation. I think before then, the regulation was just about right, which basically limited access to these commodities markets in Chicago mostly to basically companies that actually used oil and not and companies that were using the markets as a hedge against risks in their business. And J. Aaron, which is a subsidiary of Goldman Sachs, was able to get a regulatory reprieve from that and basically get into the market and start trading and speculating. And that sort of opened the door for a huge shift in the markets. I'm not sure what the right proportion is, but 81% is too high. I mean, maybe 30% is the right percentage, and the 70% would be people who actually use the oil in their business. But what this does is it just creates big distortions, and it allows prices to fluctuate wildly, especially because you have borrowed money. It's like what happened during the financial crisis when banks were borrowing $30 or up to $50 for every dollar of capital to buy these mortgage-backed securities. And, you know, if things are going up in value, your profits go up. And if things go down, you get wiped out very quickly. I mean, at a ratio of 50 to 1 or 30 to 1, it takes a 1 to 3% drop in the value of the asset that you bought to completely wipe you out. So, you know, we really need to limit the amount of leverage in our markets. Free markets is not a good idea. There has to be some limits to that, unless you think it's okay for the government to spend $23.8 trillion bailing out Wall Street when it has a little blip.
Well, now, those are completely separate questions. I still want to come back to your whole idea about speculators and oil. And you said that they leverage their money in order to buy these futures contracts, and then they have to sell them when there are small variations in price. But the problem, or the thing that I'm trying to get my arms around, Peter, is this. For every seller, there's got to be a buyer. For every buyer, there's got to be a seller. So for every seller that benefits from this, there's a buyer that is definitely getting hurt by this. And in the end, don't those two things wash themselves out?
Well, I think what really happens is that you have a situation where, you know, the American consumer is paying more, and the economy is losing because you end up with a 0.5% drop in GDP growth for every $10 increase in the price of oil. So they're all losing, and a few traders are the ones who are really making money on these things.
All right.
Now, you know, I don't know. You know, every time one of these traders goes in and does one of its transactions, I mean, I couldn't begin to tell you. I'm sure that there are a lot of these traders on both sides of the transaction are hedged, so that, you know, they're limiting their losses. And so it's probably fairly complicated. But one thing that's not complicated is the impact of higher oil prices and higher gasoline prices on overall economic growth.
Without a doubt. We're talking to Peter Cohan, everybody, author of the book Capital Rising and also CEO of Peter S. Cohan & Associates. Peter, I mean, everything that we're talking about right now just shows the impact that world events are having on oil prices and just really how globally interconnected the world economy is. Now, you've just finished writing this book called Capital Rising to help make sense of the new global economy. Tell me about your new book, and what is your main point there?
The main point is that my co-author and I, and my co-author is a really brilliant guy. I could go on and on about how brilliant he is, but we were observing the phenomenon of rising global private capital flows. Just to give you some statistics, in 2001, private capital flows, and we're talking here about money from venture capital firms and private equity firms and institutional investors going around the world, have increased at a 33% annual rate from $30 billion in 2001 to about $150 billion in 2007, and that number continues to grow much more rapidly than the flow of foreign direct investment, which is companies investing around the world. And we looked at this phenomenon and said, what is going on? What is causing this phenomenon to take place? Why are these capital flows happening. And what is the impact of these capital flows on the global economy and on the economies of countries? And how should entrepreneurs and managers and capital providers react to these changes? And how can they benefit from the risks and the opportunities created by this new wave of globalization? So that's, you know, that's really the set of research questions that we wanted to answer in our book.
Okay. And what did you conclude?
We concluded that the key factor that described whether a country was going to get capital or not, and the way to think about the whole thing, was to posit the existence of something called an entrepreneurial ecosystem. An entrepreneurial ecosystem is something that exists within a country, and it consists of four elements. Corporate governance, which is basically how companies are managed and how minority shareholders are treated. Financial markets, which has to do with how you raise capital, both for a startup and for a large company. Human capital, which has to do with the people and the skills in your country. And finally, the way you protect intellectual property. If you analyze a country based on those four factors, those elements of the entrepreneurial ecosystem, we found that capital flows to countries that have better entrepreneurial ecosystems. And in countries that have weaker entrepreneurial ecosystems, like China, for instance, even though there is capital flowing into China, the capital is flowing in such a way that it gets around the weaknesses of that country's entrepreneurial ecosystem. To give you an example, in China, the protection for intellectual property is much weaker than it is in the United States.
To say the least.
So a U.S. Venture capitalist investing in a Chinese startup is going to avoid investing in a Chinese startup where there's any intellectual property involved. Instead, they will build a service company. To give you an example of this, there was a venture capitalist that I spoke with in doing the research for the book who invested in a Vietnamese company that provides a sort of mobile payment service with technology that's well established. There's nothing novel about the technology, but the service itself was in great demand, and he made 100 times his money. If you look at a lot of the successful China-based, Shanghai-based startups, a lot of them are things like the eBay of China or the Amazon of China. They're basically taking a business model that's been established in the U.S. and shown to work, and they're doing it for the huge 1.3 trillion person population in China. So that's the way that investors are sort of getting around that lack of intellectual property protection in China, by taking an existing piece of intellectual property and putting it into a service business.
Well, it's a fascinating thesis. We're talking to Peter Cohan, everybody, author of the book Capital Rising, also CEO of his own firm, Peter S. Cohan & Associates. Peter, if people want to learn more about you, maybe learn more about your company or your book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
I would suggest petercohan.com, P-E-T-E-R-C-O-H-A-N.com, and there's information about my book, my company, and my blog, all sorts of stuff.
All right, petercohan.com. Peter, thank you so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Brainy.
Oh, thanks. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay.